Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Luisa Franco, in this week for Brian Winter. 7 months into Gustavo Petro's government in Colombia, the administration is dealing with a deluge of challenges. Could this moment mark a change in how he governs?
So I'm scared of moves like him appealing directly to the people, and in that sense, challenging representative democracy.
Colombia's Gustavo Petro is facing a number of crises at the moment. There have been challenges on the security front. The handling of a proposed health care reform has created fissures in the broad front cabinet that he came into office with the resignation of three ministers, including Alejandro Gaviria, who served under former President Juan Manuel Santos. In the meantime, Petro's son is being accused of keeping irregular donations to his father's presidential campaign, and Petro's brother of promising to help drug traffickers enroll in the government's peace negotiations with armed groups. On top of this, a slower economy and inflation of above 13% a year are not helping. Petro's popularity has fallen below 50%. Some fear the president could turn more intolerant of dissent moving forward. What Petro should we expect to see from now on? We have a return guest this week, journalist Mariana Palau. She and I talked last year about what her expectations were for this government. And now she's back to give us her overview 7 months into Petro's term. Mariana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mariana, as I said in the introduction, the Petro administration is facing some problems right now. Do you feel like this could be some sort of turning point in his government? And if you do, what does that turning point look like to you?
It could be. I think I should stress something that people don't realize enough. And it's just that the symbol of Gustavo Petro is a very powerful one, because for the first time in Colombia's history, we have a government that at least claims to represent the underrepresented ethnic minorities, the poor, even LGBTI communities. And the simple fact that he tries to be more inclusive of people who haven't been included, the simple fact that people can see on a stage together with the president, people of color or more women, that in itself is incredibly powerful. I mean, there's a lot of criticism as to whether he's actually that inclusive and as to whether he will actually alleviate poverty. That's like a policy issue. That's a conversation aside. But I think that he's been able to construct this image that is a very powerful image. That being said, we have seen the president's support decrease recently. I think that the scandals that you mentioned are a huge issue and they can dent the president's image. But I think Gustavo Petro has a more meaningful problem, and it's the economy. And that's not exactly his fault. Colombia's economy is overheated, definitely. And this is partly what happened during the previous government. There was a very generous fiscal policy. There was a very expansive monetary policy, and that was because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's what this government and many other governments around the world felt like they needed to do. Fast forward to 2023, and Colombia has one of the highest inflation rates of Latin America. It was above 13% in February compared to a year ago. So now what we are going to see, and what in effect needs to happen for our economic health, is the economy contracting. That's what we really need to see. The question is, can Gustavo Petro fulfill his campaign promises of, you know, alleviating inequality, of pulling people out of poverty in this context?
Petro built a government of coalition with people who didn't necessarily agree with him on everything. Most notably, he appointed José Antonio Campo as finance minister, someone who describes himself as center-left social democrat. and is widely respected by people in the markets. Last time you were on the podcast, you said he also had a reputation for not being very tolerant of disagreement when he was mayor of Bogota in the early 2010s. So where are you seeing the pendulum swing between this more accommodating and a more combative style of leadership?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the fact of the matter is that at some point, Gustavo Petro is going to have to cede to the pressures of those that criticize him. Because, for example, as of right now, he doesn't really have the votes to pass the healthcare reform law the way that it is. And I think that Gustavo Petro can be predictable in the sense that he doesn't like to be contradicted, definitely. There is a possibility that he kind of retreats more into this position where he's like, I'm the president, I was elected for this purpose, therefore you need to support me, right? But look, there's also the possibility that the president might just say, if I want to get anything done, I have to come to a middle ground and I have to accept some kind of contradiction, and I'm not going to be able to do everything that I want to do because it's about reaching a consensus.
Which he did with the tax reform, right? And just for context, in November, the Colombian Congress approved a tax reform plan proposed by the Petro administration, which raises taxes on fossil fuels and richer Colombians, and that the government expects will generate additional revenue to spend on social programs without increasing debt.
I think that what happened with the tax reform was also that it was the beginning of his presidency, so he really needed to send a message that will calm investors and the markets abroad. Because there was a lot of talk that Colombia was going to go down this path where it could become, I don't know, something like Venezuela or something. And when he named Ocampo as finance minister, you know, he's a technocrat, probably the last technocrat left in his office right now in his cabinet, but he's a technocrat. And he also came up with this moderate reform, then he sent a signal to markets that, you know, Colombia is still a safe place to invest. Definitely the tax reform, it was at the beginning of his presidency. He didn't have any major opposing voices back then. But he does have a very defined path to where he wants to take the country. And I think the healthcare reform shows that he wants a bigger state and more state intervention. And Colombia has had this tradition of putting these technocrats since the 70s in government positions. So it's the Ministry of Finance, for example, the Ministry of Healthcare. The last 12 years has been led by very capable technocrats. The same thing with the Ministry of Mining and Energy. Now you don't have Gaviria, who is one of the most respected technocrats in the country. And you kind of have Ocampo left, and he's kind of pulling the brakes on a lot of things that Petro wants to do, but that could potentially be economically disastrous for the country. And so that's when the president's support starts to wane, because there's a lot of powerful political elite individuals that do not agree with this vision of a country that he has, and that want to somehow kind of stop that. And they have influence in Congress. Some of them are in Congress.
You were just referring to José Antonio Ocampo, the finance minister, who symbolizes the consensus-building cabinet that Petro came into office with. He worked on the presidential campaign of one of Petro's opponents, actually. Last time you were on, you said that Ocampo probably was not going to stay for the whole term. Is that how you see it still?
To me, at least, it's obvious that he can extend that time period, but it's a very exhausting position. And this might take a toll, as it does for every finance minister in Colombia. I think that if he does leave, that's when there's going to be a lot of panic, because people see him as the guardian of the technocratic policy-making process.
Mariana, as you well know, some critics of Petro worry that he represents a threat to Colombia's institutions. How do you see this debate?
So I'm scared of moves like him appealing directly to the people and in that sense, challenging representative democracy. For example, when he announced the draft of the healthcare reform was ready and that he was presenting it to Congress, he announced it from the balcony of the presidential palace to, you know, a crowd of people. And the message that Colombians got from that was the people should take precedent over the policymaking process in Congress. And that kind of worries me, because to me, that is a challenge to the institutional architecture of the country and the state of law. The Uribistas actually have done this before. They have also said that people's desires and people's wish and the issues that they voted for should come before the state of law or the Estado de Derecho. And I disagree with that. You know, I really believe in representative democracy. So I'm really worried in that sense. A lot of people criticize Gustavo Petro, but I think that in focusing on criticizing him, they're failing to see that Colombia voted for this man for a reason. And I really think there was a lot of anger behind people's decisions to vote. And Gustavo Petro does represent hope for a lot of people. And so I'm not sure, you know, how much this criticism will actually help to make him a better president or to make his government work better. I very much fear that it will force him to retreat into a position where he says, I'm the defender of the people, you know, whatever his definition of the people, and whoever once stands against me doesn't understand the people and is going against the people. That's something that really worries me, because I think it can polarize a country even further. We're not going to be a functioning democracy if the country is that polarized. It can lead to very terrible consequences. I'm more worried about what the Petro government's lack of capacity to execute can do to the country than the actual challenge that it might represent to Colombia's institutions. Because I think Colombia's institutions are strong, particularly when you compare them to most countries in the region, right? And I think they can withstand these challenges. That being said, I don't think it's a good sign that any president is challenging institutions, even if it is in their messaging, in the way that they speak. We didn't used to see this under Juan Manuel Santos or under, you know, President Obama, but we see this much more in presidents like Donald Trump. So I don't think that it's a very positive message. But that is a threat that could materialize further in the future. For now, I think it's the lack of capacity to execute that I find more worrying.
How do you mean?
Your lack of capacity to execute can actually set back that progress that we have been able to see, even if it's a moderate progress, for so many years. And that in the end, again, can lead to a situation where in the future, there is a greater challenge to institutions. Because if people don't see their situations improve, then they're going to stick to something that is far more radical.
Let's move on to the issue of security, which is crucial for Colombians. Petro has moved on paz total, right? The idea that the government would hold peace negotiations simultaneously with all different kinds of armed groups, from those who are ideologically motivated to those who are merely financially motivated drug traffickers. Can you give us an overview of how it's going?
It's interesting because the nature of Colombia's violence today is very different from the violence that we saw during the conflict, right? The conflict in Colombia was very much, at least in its beginning, and one of its fuels was a political ideology. It was the FARC trying to overthrow the government and kind of installing a more Marxist-leaning regime. Colombia's modern-day armed groups, there's a plethora of them, are more like organized crime groups, right? So I'm talking about, for example, the FARC dissidents, and they are FARC members who refused to sign the peace deal because they found it more enticing to continue with the drug trafficking business. You have the Clan del Golfo, which was kind of set up by former paramilitary members, the right-wing paramilitary members, and they as well, a huge drug trafficking organization. And like this, you have so many groups in Colombia. And so the interesting part of this is that these groups are not exactly waging a war against the state anymore. So they're not attacking, for example, the armed forces. What they are doing is fighting each other for control of territory and for control of the trafficking routes that have been established throughout Colombia. In doing so, they're spreading a lot of violence and affecting citizens massively, right? So massacres have increased, killings of social leaders have increased drastically. So the idea of Paz Total is not that the government exactly is a negotiator with an armed group that has a political inclination. It's more that it has a mediatory role between all of these groups that are fighting each other. And it tries to give them some incentives, right, in order to engage in this negotiation, right? Stop the violence, stop the drug trafficking, stop the illegal economies, and we'll give you these incentives. I think it's pretty important that the president and his government seek a negotiated way out of this cycle of violence, because negotiation should always be on the table, right? And in the end, the state can play a very important role in kind of negotiating or coordinating these groups into negotiating. But the fact that the government is a mediator doesn't mean that it can simply forget about a military strategy or a strategy of force that pushes these groups to negotiate, right? So if you don't have the stick, if the state doesn't have the stick, then there's no carrot at the negotiating table that is going to be enticing enough for these groups to sit down and eat, right? And that is where you have major fallbacks when it comes to Paz Total, right? There's more than 20 groups who have said that they want to be part of this initiative, but they're still killing civilians. There's still massacres throughout the country. These groups are still killing social leaders. And the government kind of doesn't impose any limits or try to get them to cease the violence in exchange for coming to the table with this mediator that is the government. There's no clarity on the conditions of these negotiations. What are the limits that these groups should respect in order to access all of these benefits that they could get if they actually come to an agreement? And so under these circumstances, it's really hard. You know what I mean? Because what motive or what incentive are these groups actually going to have to sit down and negotiate? It's definitely laudable that he tries to negotiate that the government tries to play a mediatory role here. But there has to be some kind of military strategy, even something, in order to push these groups to negotiate. You also have a very, very serious drug trafficking problem in Colombia, and Colombia is exporting more coca than ever before. And, you know, as long as that is there, it's just going to be very hard. It's just a business that is so lucrative that it's going to be very hard for these groups to leave behind. So that's kind of out of his control in this case, but it's another issue that represents a huge obstacle in the way to total peace. There's a decent amount of opposition to this initiative because, you know, people are tired of organized crime. And that is one thing that really moves public opinion and therefore representatives' choices in how they behave, for example, in Congress. So, you know, I think that's one area that can really come back and haunt Gustavo Petro. If the killings of social leaders don't stop, if the massacres don't stop, if even things like thefts or just these like levels of violence and crime don't stop, how are people going to live? And that's going to translate into a lack of support for Petro. And he really needs to be careful with that.
And ultimately, his wish is that drugs be legalized, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't depend on him. And I think Gustavo Petro is very right in actually, you know, calling for the world to rethink their strategy against drugs. You know, it clearly hasn't worked. And there is no other country in the world that has suffered the consequences of a failed war on drugs than Colombia. I mean, the violence that Colombia has been subjected to is a direct consequence of this war on drugs. And so, you know, it only makes sense that Gustavo Petro and presidents before him, Juan Manuel Santos did this as well, called for a different strategy and even legalizing drugs. But, you know, yeah, if he wants to legalize drugs within Colombia, that's definitely not going to work. Kind of need the whole world to cooperate in order for a different system to take hold and for the violence to end.
Aside from the healthcare reform, the administration has presented to Congress a development plan based on ambitious goals pertaining to access to water, to nutrition, dealing with poverty and climate change. There's a lot there. What can we expect from it?
I think this is where Petro needs to be a bit careful, because he can't pass all of these very ambitious reforms and laws and development plans. He just can't. He might pass one very ambitious and radical one in the sense that it might achieve a lot of change in the way things work, but he cannot do all of them. So, you know, it depends like on how the discussion around, for example, the healthcare reform will go. If that is bitter, then his other reforms will probably suffer. If he is able to come to a middle ground and appease opposers, then he might achieve more with other reform initiatives. It remains to be seen, however, you know, Petro's proven to be very politically gifted before. And it really depends on his relationship with Roy Barreras, who's the president of the Senate, and who is even more skilled in terms of politics and playing the political game than Petro is. He's been in all governments. I think a lot of it depends on if he's still on Petro's side, which he should be, because he's like part of Petro's coalition. In fact, he's one of like the traditional politicians that came out first to support Gustavo Petro.
Finally, last time you were on, I asked you what Petro's odds of success were. And you said that Colombians' expectations have been raised since the peace accord with the FARC. And he wanted to do a lot of different things. You argued that if he were able to move to do some of that, that would already be a success, but that he'd have to choose because he wanted to do so many different things. How do you evaluate his success so far?
So I think that I worry a lot about his leadership style, because it seems like Petro wants to achieve these very important changes that could have lead to immense benefits for Colombians, but he seems to want to achieve them in one day. And he seems to lack a strategy or a plan to do this kind of thing. So I'll give you an example, the energy transition, Colombia's energy transition, right? You know, of course, Colombia has to decrease its dependence on fossil fuel. But at the same time, you have to consider that there's Colombia's energy sovereignty and energy security. And there's Colombia's dependence economically on oil exports. What are we going to do in order to transition, to not leave, you know, millions of people without a resource that they depend on, to not leave the country without a resource that they depend on economically, but also to come up with solutions to generate energy that people need in order to lead healthy lives? That's the worry that I have. I think Gustavo Petro has some very good ideas. I listen to him and I think that he's right in many of the things that he says. It's his execution capacity that worries me, because there doesn't seem to be a plan or even an attempt to organize a plan. Everything seems so disorderly. And, you know, that's a problem, because that's, in the end, you're not going to execute anything that way. And specifically with the energy transition, the more disorderly it is, the more expensive it's going to be, because, you know, you're going to have to come up with some last minute solutions.
Mariana, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We hope to keep this tradition of speaking to you every 6 months.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly Podcast is produced by Luisa Franco and edited in partnership with Human Group Media.